Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And for about a year now, for about 40 episodes now, I've been saying we discuss and explore monsters in, among other things, games. And yet, for the longest time, I never once mentioned any monster in a game, so I'm catching up on that. And I have a pattern. This is about the third episode in which I talk to a gamer. This time I get to talk with Amazon.com best-selling RPG book supplement author Matt Davids. He's game master at DiceGeeks.com. You can find out all sorts of information about his publications, about his supplements, about all his projects, including his new podcast there on DiceGeeks.com. We end up talking about all sorts of things, from monsters to some really sage advice about how you can get some of your own projects up and running, and how the new world of self-publishing plays into that. So I hope you enjoy. Well, first of all, thank you for coming on The Monster Professor, Matt Davids.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for inviting me, Josh.
Yeah, I first ran into you, or I first found out about you, at the Edwardsville Book Festival. Edwardsville, Illinois, they were holding their first one, so their inaugural festival, looking through the authors. And then I see some RPG guy on the list, and then I look into his books. And that's you, by the way, that is going third person with us. And then I found bestsellers on Amazon in the RPG category, by the way. Congratulations. These books of yours, Random Tables. There's book upon book upon book of random tables of things that you might run into if you're engaging in a tabletop role-playing game. I immediately thought there are more uses for these tables than just to role-playing games. But anyway, I'm fascinated about it. And got to talk to you there at the festival, and turns out you have this whole world going on through DiceGeeks.com, and even are starting a new project. So tell us a little bit about what DiceGeeks is, or what we can find there, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, DiceGeeks.com is my website where I kind of just gather together all of the books and RPG resources that I create. And as you mentioned, one of the main things that I create are books of random tables. And if anybody doesn't really understand that, when you're playing a tabletop role-playing game, there comes a time if your players are searching any type of room or in a dungeon or in a castle or in a manor house or something, that they want to know what's in that room. Well, you can figure out what's in that room by spending, you know, a few hours before each session planning out what's in that room, or while you're at the table, and if your players search the room, you can just roll on one of my random tables and you can find items in that room that they can then kind of search through or pillage or take or whatever it is that they're doing. And this, just to me, not only does it save a ton of time, but it just takes a lot of the pressure off of the game master just to come up with those things kind of on the fly, because players always, always want to search the room, even if the game master says there's nothing in the room. And, you know, they're like, well, I roll again. Is there, I said there was nothing in the room, and even saying there's nothing in the room doesn't really give a satisfying experience to the player as well. So this way, if they come into the room, they find maybe the note or something that I wanted them to find for the campaign, then everybody else searches the room. I can just pull out one of these tables, have them roll their search roll or perception or whatever the system is, and then roll on that table, and it fills out the room with kind of items, anything from a dead rat to a piece of metal to two gold pieces or whatever it is.
Yeah, and that leads my mind in a couple of different directions, both of which you've already anticipated or planned out. And one of them is this idea of running an entirely impromptu game. I think this standard or the default maybe for role-playing games is to gather your friends together and then play out a story that's kind of been planned along with plenty of options for openness or randomness throughout. But using that kind of randomized method, I mean, what are your thoughts on improvised games?
Yeah, I mean, running a session without preparing is kind of my whole platform. And it kind of became that way because when I was younger, you know, I had a lot of time. So I would plan out everything. I would plan out every item in the room. I would plan out what's happening every place that I possibly could. And what I always ran into was my players didn't care what I planned out. And they didn't care where I had planned something. They didn't care if I had put, you know, this certain thing in this one room. They were just doing what they wanted to do. And if I filled all, say, you know, 87 rooms of a dungeon with items, well, what if they only go to 40 of those 87 rooms? You know? And so,
yeah, or even worse, what happens is they don't want to go in the dungeon at all. They spend the whole time in the bar and in bar fights.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yes. And that has happened. And that has certainly happened to me. And also the worst, I guess, case is that the session or the campaign gets canceled.
Yeah.
And then I had created all of this stuff and nobody ever gets to see it. And what I learned, you know, just some years back, it's that when I was improvising the campaign, when I was using the dice to tell the story, that it just flowed better. I didn't know what was coming ahead in many cases, so I was very interested in seeing where these characters were going to go, and it just felt a lot better. Plus, you know, now that I'm older, I have a family and, you know, you have jobs and things. And it's just like, you can't, you know, if you get 3 hours per week to play a session, that is about all that a person can kind of carve out of their schedule. If you have, you know, if you need to spend another 3 hours, 6 hours, 10 hours, prepping to play those 3 hours, I mean, it's just not going to happen. So just realistically, yeah. I have to, you know, I think going no prep is the way to go. And of course, I just put out a book called The No Prep Game Master to kind of give some people some ideas of how to do that.
Yeah. And that seems a whole lot, another direction that leads me, it seems a whole lot like a description of a really good experience of writing a book or a story from a say traditional writing rather than like a tabletop narrative. Although I think the two are intimately connected, but there's something rich and inspiring when you have that feeling of exploration. I'm quite an outliner. I like outlining and I like structure and I like knowing where I'm going, but I always make sure to build in when I'm doing my own writing, those moments in which you can, discover or find out or even be surprised. And that seems to be where the real narrative energy lies. And that's where I see kind of your approach to those randomized, tables coming along. For instance, you have one on like, at least one, maybe you have more on random tables of science fiction, for instance. You know, I just see this as being so useful for instance, if you're a science fiction writer and your characters go into a cargo hold, maybe you know what's going to happen after that. But take a moment and write that scene in the cargo hold. You can, if your mind's somewhere else or you want to focus on the characters or you just want to see what happens, you can just flip open, I don't know, page 27 out of your book, and you find out that there's a plasma beam drill and a chronometer and a med kit and, let's see, polymer fiber rope and then a vacuum suit, right? And that okay. might very well change the way that the story goes. I don't know. But something about it suddenly becomes a little bit more alive. So I'm going this narrative route. But I think you are already going that route. And that's a little bit connected to your new podcast project. So I'm going to throw both of those at you. go either direction you want to, narrative or podcast. Tell us more.
Okay. Well, yeah, kind of just following up with the narrative idea. I have been contacted by at least one novelist who says that he uses my tables to fill rooms in his novels when he writes. And when I first heard that, I hadn't really thought of that. But when he mentioned that I was just kind of, you know, at first just kind of blown away by it. But then as I started thinking about it, of course you could do that, especially if you have, you know, a room where your hero or your, you know, whoever your protagonist is or whatever is just entering, you know, some room and you just need some items of kind of flair or something around in that room, you can just roll on that or to give your protagonist just a few objects that perhaps they can use in some way or to give the room atmosphere. I thought it was great. And I hadn't really thought of that. And then as far as the podcast, yes, I just launched a new podcast. And the premise behind it is really the same. You know, if you think of some great writers, I think it's always the case that you find out that they are great readers, that they have read volume after volume. And then, you know, if you think of filmmakers, some of the great filmmakers, you know, and you start listening to them or you read interviews, you just find out that they have watched like just an incredible amount of films and just kind of picking up with that idea of no prepping for your session, kind of not preparing for your RPG session and, you know, kind of taking these examples from great writers or great filmmakers. The idea is that if we fill ourselves with stories and we have knowledge of different subjects and situations, that while we are just at the table, we will have access to some of these things. And I know that the great writers have, you know, since they have experienced so many stories, they just have almost like a catalog of these ideas and situations that they can take, combine with something else, and then come up with an original idea. And I think that you know, instead of a game master just spending hours and hours of trying to, you know, prepare for this session or almost writing, you know, a campaign book or something like that, if they're just going to run a session for their friends, they can just come to the table, start playing, and different questions or different situations that arise because of dice rolls, you know, they can take those then and just build on those because they have experienced stories.
Yeah, that's deeply connected to this one piece of advice that I've never really figured out exactly how to give well when I teach writing, but it's something to the effect of addressing this concern for students, you know, who are told to say read something or watch something that mm-hmm. they're not immediately interested in. And they always want, the creative writers not as much, but maybe they're just less vocal about the instinct of wondering like, well, how's this ever going to help me? This is never going to help me. Well, mm-hmm. You don't know, though, because when the time comes that you use that or call that up to mix and match with something else for a creative idea, or you might even need that type of idea, when the time comes, if you have read it or experienced it, then you'll know if you used it. All you can really know is that ignorance isn't really helpful in that moment. and not knowing is definitely not going to help you. And so filling that toolbox with things that might not seem relevant at the moment, you just don't know until who knows when. But that's cool that you're already thinking this deeply into this realm of narrative.
Yeah, and I think it's also important that you know, say just for an example, you know, watching some of the Marvel movies, those are great. You know, watch those. But I think there is also something to be said for, you know, watching the films of Akira Kurosawa as well, you know, that you, if you expand kind of your horizons, you know, if you only read, say, you know, action adventure or something like that, there is a benefit to breaking outside of that genre occasionally and just picking up something else. And I just think that it's never really lost, even if you don't know where you're going to use it, or even if you're thinking of it consciously, it goes into, you know, into your mind, into your memories, into your imagination, and it just broadens that scope. So then when you approach either the gaming table or writing, that you just have, you know, like in some sense, right, the well needs to be deep, right? So you can draw from it and, you know, really create something that people would be interested in.
Yeah, I'm completely with you on that. And I think everybody needs to watch Kurosawa no matter what field they're in.
Absolutely.
And now if people are listening to this and they're wondering, wait a minute, what does any of this have to do with monsters? Why does he keep talking to gaming people? Well, I think there is a definite connection. You're not the first, nor will you be the last RPG-related person that I want to talk to on this show. And I think part of it is because what is required for a complete gaming experience? These aren't my rules. These are just things I've noticed. You need players, although sometimes they're called heroes, whether or not they're heroic is left to question, but people playing this game, we care about that. We care about who our characters are that we're playing. You know, and then we care very much about what type of setting, and then it doesn't feel complete unless there are monsters in there. It's like the third. It's not enough for a bunch of players to be in a fantasy setting or a starship setting and needing to confront like an engineering or an ecological problem. It doesn't feel complete until a damn monster shows up and we have to fight him. Why, Matt Davins? Why do we need monsters to have complete gaming experiences?
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer that. I think you're correct that you can do some of those things. You can just throw a problem and say, you know, hey, the warp drive's out, or there's a pit and you have to cross it or something like that. But it doesn't seem complete unless there's a monster. And it's just in the, you know, the form of a tabletop game, especially say Dungeons and Dragons, it's right there in the name, right? You have to fight a monster. But I think, you know, part of it has to be just the necessity to overcome kind of an intelligent foe in some way, even if the monster might be kind of brutish or something. But it's just something that is actively trying to destroy you.
Yeah.
And that you have to then overcome it. Kind of, I mean, it may harken back to like the most dangerous game kind of concept, but just not being you know, another person, but it, you know, it adds kind of an extra level. So you think, okay, well, I have to face a person, you know, that would be a tough challenge. But if you then take that and make them a monster and say, okay, well, they're 25 times stronger than any, you know, man is, you know, or they have certain abilities that men don't have or something like that. And so then you are just left with a great challenge, and that there is kind of a satisfaction in overcoming that.
Yeah. And you've been running these kinds of games. I mean, you've been running these kinds of games for years. When did you first get into RPGs and running games?
Well, the first time I played Dungeons & Dragons, I was 9 years old. And the first time I ran a game, the first time that I was the Dungeon Master, was the next day. And I ran my mom through a dungeon.
Oh, and, no, you played with your mom?
Well,
isn't that the height of geekdom?
Well, I was nine. If, you know, if I was okay. 21, maybe.
Fair enough.
But I was nine. So, you know, who else was I going to play with, right? So, you know, I had played with a group of friends who introduced me to it the night before. And then I just took to it, right? And I was just fascinated by it, and I just had to do something. Of course, I didn't know any of the rules. I don't even remember exactly, but like I just had her, you know, have a few numbers of things that we could roll against, and I just started making up a dungeon, and I'm sure it was crazy, but you know, my mom humored me, and then, you know, it didn't really stop from there. So I just kept, you know, playing mainly basic D&D, but then I started playing, you know, Marvel superheroes. I started playing Star Frontiers. These are a lot of old games. Star Trek, the old FASA system. And then there was the Star Wars game that came out by West End Games. It came out, I think, when I was 14 or so. And that game really changed everything, because I could then, since the 6D system was so simple to use, I could teach that to friends who didn't role play, and I could make them a character in 10, 15 minutes. I could teach them the system in, you know, 25 minutes, 30 minutes. And we could be playing. And since everybody knew Star Wars, knew the universe, it was just really easy for them to step into. So for a long time, I ran that game just because I was able to get players, because I would mention, hey, do you like Star Wars? Well, you know, the answer was always yes. And then it was like, you want to actually be in the universe? And it was like, well, that sounds interesting. Well, I can make a character really quickly, instead of kind of during some of those years, the Dungeons and Dragons, like second edition and stuff, you know, it would take a good, you know, 4 to 8 hours to make a character, you know, in D&D. So,
second edition was like, but I loved that. I loved making characters. Sometimes we'd make characters running through one thing and then start a new campaign and make new characters.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I played second edition some, but it was always just, you know, it was always just, you know, you could just never get a large group, or at least I couldn't, because it was like, who has 8 hours to sit here and make a character or whatever, you know? And that was just some of the problems with some of the older games, even the Star Trek FASA system. I mean, that's still, I think the first character I made took me like a week, right? I mean, it was just so complex. But now, you know, you can make a character for Dungeons and Dragons in a half hour, and in fifth edition, and it's fantastic. And I think that's helped the popularity of it as well, along with some of the podcasts and Critical Role and some of the things like that.
Yeah. And so in your experience then as a game master, since you were nine, are there certain monsters that you would suggest for all the game masters out there wanting to level up their game? So, or maybe even new ones out there wanting to run a campaign. They're like, you know, if I'm going to build it around a monster, or if I'm going to throw monsters, at my players, but I want this kind of live, dynamic kind of experience. Are there some that are your go-to monsters or that you would suggest, you know, leaning toward?
I don't know. I don't know if I have, kind of in the gaming space, I don't know if I have just a go-to monster. Because it just always depends on the situation that you're in, and unless you know you want to make some kind of themed game or something like that, I can see if you want to do a theme inside of a dungeon, then of course you could say, well, I take a mummy lord or something like this, and then you'd have sarcophagi and things that you could kind of play with and make a theme in there. But yeah, I don't really have just kind of a go-to one. It's just seems to be, especially in Dungeons and Dragons, it always just seems to be what I think would challenge the characters, and not just necessarily from saying, okay, well, the characters are, you know, maybe level 3. So if the monster has X hit points, it will take them a while to kill it or something like that. But just what will challenge the players? Does the monster have some kind of, you know, charm spell? Does he have some kind of, you know, ability to, you know, to just take the players, you know, kind of, you know, catch them off guard, instead of, you know, if you run for a while and you say you just have some kind of low level monsters that are just obstacles, taking something that has, you know, a little twist to it, that has some kind of unique ability to it, and kind of putting that in front of the players, you know, they kind of get kind of in the mode of, okay, well, we just stab it and move on.
Yeah.
But if you can kind of give them something, you know, some monster with some ability that kind of throws that for a loop, you know, something that's trying to charm them, or something that is, you know, can make illusions or something like that, then for, you know, at least for an instant, they are just caught off guard and they have to really think about how to defeat that creature. But yeah, I don't really have a go-to monster in a game. I mean, in Dungeons and Dragons, I mean, you have so many that you can choose from. I mean, it's just incredible with the Monster Manual and the years of the different editions and things. You just have so many that you can choose from, you know, and they're all kind of unique in their own way. So you can just kind of throw a lot of those at them. In Star Wars, you know, monsters, you know, it's always fun to have them fight a Rancor every once in a while. Everybody loses their mind if they get to fight a Rancor.
And you've been getting into a little bit of thinking through the foundations of monsters too with your podcast. So I don't think I've said congratulations on starting your podcast yet. So first of all, congratulations on that. And I know about it because you were generous enough to invite me on this show. So if listeners are already interested, and if one more thing will push you to go check out the Dice Geeks podcast, then I'm on there too.
You don't want to miss the Monster Professor.
and you also talked to what is the was it John Walsh is the curator of the Ray Harryhausen? How would you describe the title? I'm going to screw it up. You know?
Yeah. I was able to interview John Walsh. He is a trustee of the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, and he has a new book out. And if you're not familiar, if the listeners aren't familiar with the name Ray Harryhausen, he was just an incredible stop motion animation special effects creator on films like The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, the original Clash of the Titans, Jason and the Argonauts. And he was a true genius, that he did work on those films, you know, by himself, that 100 or more people nowadays do the work of, and he would just do them by himself. And so, yes, John Walsh was very generous, came on the show, and we talked about Ray Harryhausen's films.
Yeah, and that's, and talk about getting down to the heart of how to tell these stories and involve monsters. I mean, Ray Harryhausen was a saint of monster makers, right? He would make them come to life like nobody had ever really seen before. I mean, I guess the big change up was King Kong, but then Ray Harryhausen came along and took that up way up. So you want to talk shop for a second? How's the release in the podcast going? And what do you think of the podcasting world right now?
Well, I think the release is going well. I think I'm still naive enough not to know if it's bad or anything.
Same here. I have no idea if this show is awful or good or what, but I'm having fun with it.
So. Yeah. And just being able to talk to so many people from just diverse backgrounds so far is just been, I don't know, it's just been fantastic. And I am just so surprised with how generous people are with their time and allowing me to interview them when they have, I am sure, you know, much more important things that they could be doing. And, as far as like launching a podcast, it is almost ridiculous how easy it is to get it up and put it up online and get it submitted to the directories. That part was no problem. Me learning how to talk into a microphone is a different story, but I think it's been going well, and now I just have to figure out how to market my podcast.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but when I first started recording myself, my first podcasts were solo. I think I would have been wiser starting by talking to others as you have, but I had like monsters and literature lectures that I thought I would start a podcast around and do an episode on a different type of monster and keep that going for a while and see what happens. But as soon as I hit record, all of a sudden I froze up and freaked out. It was just awful. I can talk to a whole stadium full of people, give a lecture or give a reading, no problem. Mm-hmm. But by myself, for some reason, I couldn't handle it, and I hated hearing the sound of my own voice. How was your experience getting started in that?
very similar, that I recorded the interview and my first day that I was going to add a hook and an intro on the show and put it all together in an episode, I kind of just sat at the computer for about 10 minutes, just not wanting to press play, just not wanting to hear my voice. And so I eventually did. And I say, well, I've just did it just now that I'm becoming more aware of. I say, yeah, you know, and quite a lot. And I am trying to get those out of my speech.
Oh, I don't know if you need to necessarily. I'm not worried about it for myself, and I stutter all the time. And when I hear the really clean edited ones, I don't know. I don't like those quite as much. So anyway, the feedback I always get is they like the sloppy kind of going random places episodes as much as I do, because they're always a little bit more fun anyway, for what it's worth.
Okay. Well, that's encouraging.
And speaking of random jumps, now for something completely different. I want to hit you with a question that I try to hit everybody with, no matter what their expertise. And we can do two different categories for this one if you want. I'm curious, what is your favorite monster of all time? And since you're an RPG expert, we could do like your favorite RPG monster and then regular monster, but you're allowed to combine the two into one if you feel like it. So Matt Davids, what's your monster?
Well, like I said, with the RPGs, I don't know if I have just like a basic favorite one to use in RPGs, just because I like trying to find a monster that works in the situation and that presents a unique challenge for the players. Now, for me personally, I don't know if this is cheating, but I don't know if there's a specific monster, but the kind of the class or the category of my favorite would have to be dragons.
Yeah.
And just because it's almost hard to even define a dragon, because we see dragons kind of in the ancient creation epics in the Near East of being kind of a representation of chaos. In the Bible, the dragon is identified, of course, with the tempter and the accuser. Then, kind of in later Western literature, the dragon is the hoarder of treasure, and then in some cases also knowledge, but there's no purpose really in the hoarding of the riches, right? They hoard all these gold pieces and things and treasures just to sleep upon them, not to spend them or not to enjoy them. The ones that kind of hoard knowledge in the same way, they don't collect the knowledge to share it with anybody. They keep it to themselves. So there's a lot going on there from the earliest times that, we can explore so many themes that at the end of every quest, it just almost seems like there should be a dragon.
Yeah. And you're kind of hinting at this universal appeal to them, that you can find them throughout time all over the place, except, I mean, there are some places, you could say there are some tribes, across the middle band of Africa that don't really have dragons in their tails, but they do have serpents, and so that's darn close.
Yeah.
But a whole lot of them have this upgraded serpent. I think the two are connected, but it's so deep, I don't really know if I can get to the bottom of it, and they show up everywhere.
Yeah, and then even like the winged serpent of like South America and that.
Yeah. Man, almost a year ago, maybe half a year ago, I did an episode on dragons and serpents, and I feel like I just barely scratched the surface, and that's one people want to hear more about. But that's cool to hear that you're thinking that way too, because in a role-playing game too, they offer so many chances for a game, well, for you to really throw challenges at the players,
yes.
Right? Because you're dealing with something that's smarter than they are.
Yes. Right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And in a dragon, in Dungeons and Dragons, absolutely, that they're smarter than the characters. They've lived thousands of years, so they've amassed all of this knowledge. They can be used as villain. They can be used as a quest giver. It's just like almost the possibilities are endless, right? Like you can just run the whole spectrum. If you want a good dragon who gives quests, you want an evil dragon who the players have to defeat. It's all there and everything in between.
I'm gonna reveal my geekdom, my own geekdom here. Do you remember a role-playing game called Council of the Worms, in which the whole thing was built around your playing dragons? So,
I've heard the name, but no, I don't have much experience with that one at all.
I'm pretty sure it was D&D. It was before Wizards of the Coast came in.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was D&D, and they did this offshoot. The art was great, and it sounded amazing, and it did not work for us. I think it was a disaster. I don't really remember why, but the idea was awesome that you could play these dragons. So for people wanting to know, let's see, more about Dice Geeks, let's say they're interested in it. Well, you have other stuff too than just the podcast and the Random Tables books, man. You've got, tell us a little bit about some of the other accessories, and then where can they find your stuff, your podcast, your books?
Okay. Well, yeah, I do have the books of random tables. I have four books of random tables that are geared towards a fantasy setting. Then I have the book of random tables for science fiction. I also have a book of random tables for post-apocalyptic games. And then I actually just released another book of random tables for a fantasy setting, but it's a little different. It is the book of random tables quests. And it is essentially 1,000 quest ideas or quest starters kind of arranged in random tables so that the game master doesn't even have to have an idea for the session they're going to run. So they can sit down at the table, roll some dice, and even get the idea of what they're going to run there at the table. And then in addition to that, I have a few other books that are a little odd, I guess, but well, the one I just released most recently is called The No Prep Game Master, and that is just a series of kind of really short chapters letting people know that it's okay that you don't have to spend 20 hours a week prepping for a three-hour session, that you can make some of this stuff up at the table. I give some helpful advice about using random tables, about kind of filling yourself with stories, and also just some other tips in that you can just use right at the table so you don't have to prepare as much. And then a couple of the odd books I have, I made a campaign setting for Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. It's called Realms of Understreet. And basically the nutshell of that is it is fantasy kingdoms of rats that live under modern-day Manhattan Island. And
it's like so, the dark side of Mouse Guard or something like that.
Well, possibly. And so it was heavily influenced, of course, by The Secret of Nim or Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, The Borrowers, The Littles, some of those kind of classic children's books. And but you can kind of go kind of more dark and horror, or you can go kind of light and fun. So I kind of set up the setting to allow for play in that way. So the humans, you know, it just translates from 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons. So humans are rats, dragonborn are salamanders, halflings are mice, things like that.
Huh.
And so I put that out in a book, and then I do have another one. It's called Anarchy. It is a post-apocalyptic campaign setting, and I use the OpenD6 system, which is kind of the West End Star Wars system that I had mentioned earlier. And, that one, is kind of interesting because that was the first book that I put together, and that kind of started me on this whole kind of Dice Geeks journey. I don't know if you want to hear the whole story behind that, but essentially an old friend of mine who had play tested, because I had made up Anarchy when I was about 14 or 16 years old, and because we wanted to play Mad Max, of course, we wanted to be Mad Max, but I didn't want to shell out $100 or something to buy a game, you know. So I started making my own game where we could play kind of Mad Max post-apocalyptic stuff, and this old friend of mine who had playtested a lot for me, he died. And when I was at his funeral, you know, I ran into a lot of old friends, and I had like three of them just come up to me and say, you know, I remember playing Anarchy, you know, with this other friend and you, and it was like, whatever happened to that? And I was like, well, you know, it's in a drawer somewhere, you know, I don't even know. And so kind of having that experience, I just went ahead and kind of put it together. I pulled out a lot of my old notes. I realized that the system was totally broken. It was totally unplayable. I don't even know what we were doing. I don't know how we even did anything, but I mean, you know, we were having fun. So I kind of put that together. I went ahead and took the OpenD6 system and put it in that. And I released that book, and that just kind of opened up my eyes to this whole world of self-publishing and the kind of the self-publishing revolution that's going on. I learned what print on demand was for the first time, that I didn't have to spend $5,000 to buy, to buy 5,000 copies of my book or something like that and put them all in my basement or anything. It just kind of opened my eyes to all of this. And so that's kind of what started my journey. And after that, just kind of looking at my life and thinking, what did I want to do when I was, what is my first memory of saying, oh, I wanted to do this? And it was playing Dungeons and Dragons, saying, hey, I want to make these things. I want to make games. I want to do these things. So that kind of started my journey on, into creating Dice Geeks. And then I do have another book. It's called Dungeons for the Master. And it is just 177 hand-drawn dungeon maps, hand-drawn by me. And they're just blank maps. And then at the end of the book, there is a kind of a massive 1D100 table that you can just fill the room with kind of a couple interesting non-combat encounters. So you can just pick a map. And you don't have to have anything planned out. And as your players enter, the players' characters enter each room, then you can find out what's in that room. You don't even have to have a dungeon planned out or anything like that. And that just obviously builds on my idea that, you don't have to spend, 10 hours in prep to have a fun 2-hour, 3-hour session with your friends.
Huh. And a couple of things there are fascinating to me. One, I've been kind of toying around with wanting a GM-less role-playing game. And really, it sounds like you've already provided the solutions for me. And so I just need that. And second of all, you've referred to this kind of path of getting into this Dice Geeks from where you were previously. It looks from a distance like you've made a career out of this. Like, how much of it do you say is your day job career? And I'm keeping in mind a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are people who either, feel similarly or have these kinds of dream projects that they're really not sure whether they should commit to or how they can get them off the ground. Sometimes it's writing, sometimes it's a graphic novel, mm-hmm. film, sure. even games. Yeah. And so I think they'd be listening to you for some advice on this kind of thing. So how much of this is your career and what advice do you have for people wanting to kind of take these dreams and things they love to this next level?
Yeah, and as of I think it was April 12th of this year, Dice Geeks is my full-time job.
Ah, congratulations, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. And it wasn't easy. I started in 2014 and just kind of putting together Anarchy, and it took me, until December 2015 to publish it. It took me a long time to figure out things, to figure out how to do layout and stuff for a paperback book. So it took a lot of research and a lot of work to kind of put it together. But as far as advice, when I started, I thought, kind of best case scenario is that kind of working in the evenings and, every once in a while on the weekends, I thought, I could probably make maybe a couple $100 a month or something, with, self-publishing. And I thought that would be really cool. But just, staying with it and learning about the different things that you can do with your books and the things that you can do on Amazon. It just started becoming apparent that if I really worked at it and I really learned some things, if I really dug into, how to get books to sell on Amazon, if I really dug into where I could promote my books and things like this, that I actually make a living at it. And so, I kind of doubled down on that. I mean, my advice, really would be, for anybody else out there, you to first off, really just take kind of a serious look at what you're doing and what kind of your dreams are and what your dream projects are. And just really just ask yourself if you really want to be a writer, do you really want to be a filmmaker? Do you really want to be a novelist? Do you really want to be a tabletop RPG designer? And just kind of answer that question. And if the answer is like, well, yes, but fill in the blank, then just kind of go about your stuff, just do something else. Don't worry about it too much. But if the answer is yes, and I am willing to do what it takes, well, then you can do it. It's not like I'm rich or anything. And it's not like it happened, it's not like I released one product and I was able to quit my job. It took me a number of years. It took me a while of figuring out things. It took me learning things that I never thought I would learn. Looking at things on the back end of Amazon's platform, how to do Amazon ads, and learning all of these things that you need to learn. But, it is doable. If you want to do it, then my main advice would be kind of first off is that you have to realize, if you have a day job, then you need to figure out what time you can work on some of these things. And when I say that, I mean really work on them. So for me, I really took a hard, kind of brutal, honest look at where I was spending my time when I was coming home from work. I was saying I was spending my time with my family, but I was spending 45 minutes on Facebook or another 45 minutes on YouTube just watching nonsense or something. And so, I really took a hard look at that. I eliminated those things. I don't watch a lot of TV anymore. Things like that, that I just realized that I needed to kind of just cut out and then take that time and use it to work on my books, to learn, what I need to do, to figure out how do I do layout? How do I create a book? What is useful to people, in these books? And then, the first advice would be figure out how you can make time to really do the things that you want to do. And that just kind of goes back to, thinking about when my friend passed away. It's just like, just thinking about when it's my time, do I want my boys to say, oh, well, Dad played a lot of video games, Dad watched a lot of baseball? Or do I want them to say, Dad kind of went after his dreams and Dad did what, he always wanted to do. And he kind of continued with it even after, dozens and dozens of failures, and he continued after it. And then the other set of advice is that you can learn how to do all of the things that I've been talking about. You can learn how to do, you can learn how to upload to Amazon. You can learn how to use Amazon ads. You can learn how to lay out, your book, all by listening to podcasts and finding tutorials of different software on YouTube. So, it is all available, and uploading a book to Amazon is free. So, you can just – you don't have to have money to start these things out. I've probably put maybe at most $500 into the thing, and then everything else is just paid for itself. That if I needed to buy something else, I was able to use proceeds from my books to buy something else. So there is not a lot of the barriers have just been absolutely removed, and there is a platform sitting there, Amazon, where we can just upload for RPGs. There's a platform called DriveThruRPG that you can just upload your PDFs to. And there is, unless you buy artwork or something, that you can just put up a PDF on DriveThruRPG for free. You can put up a Kindle book on Amazon absolutely free. And it's, you know, and then even a paperback, there are free software like Scribus and things that can, they're just absolutely free, and you just have to learn how to use them just, and, you know, by watching videos on YouTube. So it's absolutely doable, but I guess the key would be, do you really want to do it? And, you know, and be brutally honest with yourself. If you don't, then don't worry about it anymore. Do your stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you want it and you just can't get it out of your mind, then make it happen.
Yeah, that's great advice, man. And I think that's going to help a lot of people out there. Everything from the pragmatic, like from the self-publishing stuff to the overall, like be honest with yourself about your life thing. I mean, even from that one into the other, like the pragmatic, the Amazon publishing. I mean, you're right. All the gates that were up and the gatekeepers you had to go through, mm-hmm. just 10 years ago, hell, 5 years ago even, yeah. they're mm-hmm. gone, man. Yeah. And I mean, you don't, even for publishing now, about a year ago, Amazon opened up their own print on demand paperback stuff. And I finally had after telling people that they should do they should get into self-publishing for their own novels and their own books. I was telling writers all the time that, but I was too scared to do that with my own novel. And then I finally said, I'm doing it, man. And so I went that route too. And you're right. It's so easy. It's right there available. And yet when I talk to other, say, novelists or other writers, the more established ones, though, the ones that already have careers, mm-hmm. it's understand their skepticism about self-publishing is understandable, sure. that they built a career without it, and they come from an era when that's a stigma. But even the young writers who have no career whatsoever and might not ever have one, but they seem to want to, I tell them about self-publishing, and it's as if I just told them, hey, you know, if you just write a contract in your own blood with Mephistopheles, you know, that'll help you out. They look at me like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, I'm not doing that at all. But it's not a deal with the devil as far as I can tell so far.
I find that's absolutely true. One of the things with, like, say, tabletop RPGs, you know, I run into, you know, people now, I see them at cons and things, and they will say something like, oh, yeah, I want to get my game published. Well, there's a problem with that. No tabletop RPG company really publishes anybody else's games. They publish their own games.
Yeah.
They don't send out a lot of things for like submissions and stuff. Maybe you can find some that you can submit, maybe a campaign or an adventure kind of idea or something like that. But like if you have a game idea, there's no company takes those. So there is no problem with self-publishing a tabletop RPG. There should not be any stigma around that. And then also for novelists, there shouldn't be a stigma around that as well. I just don't understand it, because, if you were to, say, form a publishing company, if you filled out the paperwork, made an LLC, and you got a bunch of money together, and you started asking for writers to send you manuscripts, guess what you're doing? You're self-publishing.
Yeah.
There's just no difference. It's just that you have your own company. You have your own thing. You are your brand, and you're publishing your novels. There's just no difference between a person and a publishing company. Maybe a publishing company, you know, some of the big ones have, you know, millions and billions of dollars or something, and you don't have that, but it's still the same thing. You're just a company, and you're just publishing a book. And so I don't understand that stigma either. And of course now, you know, just some of the, you know, having my books on Amazon, having them become kind of best-selling, you know, books in certain categories, and, you know, just learning more about the publishing industry, more and more publishing companies want to see what you can do even before they will want to publish your books. So there is no downside to self-publishing your novel or your role-playing game. All it does is allow people to see what kind of quality of work you put out, and then give you feedback or want to publish something that you, you know, want to hire you to write something, want to hire you to write a game. So, I mean, it only helps you in the long run to self-publish. I think where people, you know, can get hung up then is like once you publish your book, the real trick is you've done 20% of the work, right? 80% of the work is marketing the book.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people, you know, authors, writers, young writers think that the publishing company promotes the book and markets the book. And that is absolutely not true. They can put the book out there through their distribution channels, but you know, I was contacted by a publishing company and I had some talks with them and just asking them questions. They're like, oh, when you get on a podcast, you know, you can market your book. And I was like, oh, do you have a list of podcasts that I can go on? And they're like, no, you have to get on this. And I was like, okay. And then it was just like, okay, so you get my book over here. And they're like, oh, no, you do that. You know, oh, can I go on a tour where I talk in libraries? Oh, no, you have to arrange that. And, you know, and it's just, you know, you have to do it yourself. You have to take responsibility, basically, is what I'm saying. And, you know, and if you just take responsibility for it, you know, there's no reason why, you know, like college students, if, you know, if you're in college and you're listening to this and you want to be a writer and you're taking creative writing classes, maybe from Josh or somebody else or at another school, start publishing your stuff. Start publishing your stories, start publishing your novels. People will take notice. If you can, you know, figure out a few things about how to market them, people will take notice of that. You will stand apart from the crowd because people will say, oh, well, look, they believe in their writing so much that they actually published it and they're willing to stand behind it. And I just don't understand the idea of why anybody, unless you're just making millions of dollars through traditional publishing, why you just would not want to self-publish your own books.
Yeah, and there you have it, folks, from a guy who was able to quit his job to live the dream right now, because you're a professional writer. You are.
Yeah, I know. That's kind of crazy. I mean, that was one of my earliest dreams, and I just kind of had given up on it and never thought it would come true. And then just because of just some you know, just deciding to just to put out a book to kind of honor my friend started kind of this whole ball rolling.
Yeah. I do want to throw in real quick, just for the record, I do love my traditional publisher as well, my publisher that I have right now. I love them too. But that doesn't change the truth of what we've also said about self-publishing.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a different path.
Well, man, this has been a real delight talking to you, and dropping that kind of wisdom is a great place to end. How about that? So it's been real fun, and I think we've covered a lot of what I was hoping to, and if people are at all interested in exploring what to do with maybe their own games, their own creations, even their own writing, I mean, you're a great resource, and now they have that. Thanks again, man, for coming on the Monster Professor. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much, Josh. Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.